This is a special presentation from Free Speech Radio News. What happens when our country's preoccupations with race, gender, and sexuality combine in one legal case? This holiday, we bring you an in-depth look at the New Jersey Seven, a group of women who went out for a night on the town and wound up spending months in jail. I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. Stick around. On August 18th, 2006, seven young, black, queer women went to the Christopher Street Pier in New York, a place known for being queer-friendly. That may be why 20-year-old Patrice Johnson didn't blink when a male stranger asked her, "Can I get some of that?" Patrice handed him her coffee cup. Then she realized he was pointing at her crotch. The man, Dwayne Buckle, shouted homophobic remarks. He made violent threats, and then he followed the women as they walked away. There was a scuffle. The women say that Buckle punched three of them in the face, threw a lit cigarette, and yanked out one woman's hair extension. But during the fray, Buckle also got stabbed. Initially, he claimed he was stabbed by two men, onlookers who got involved in the fight. But Patrice Johnson had a small steak knife on her, and police didn't investigate Buckle's claim. The media reports that followed said savage lesbian gangs were attacking men on the street. Buckle himself was never charged with any crime, but Patrice Johnson is serving an 8-year prison sentence, and her companions have all spent at least 6 months in jail. Today, Puck Lowe brings us the story of the New Jersey Seven.
I'm at the Women's Building in San Francisco, a building unmistakable by its vibrant murals of famous women of color visible from blocks away. It's also an institution known for its progressive events and community services. The auditorium is named after feminist poet Audre Lorde, and it's so full of people that dozens more crowd into the hallway, straining for a glimpse of the speakers and performers. Tonight, hundreds of people gather to see a special guest.
Tori Dandridge is actually here.
To this crowd, Tori Dandridge is a hero. She survived and resisted a homophobic attack. And even though she and her friends were charged with attempted murder for what many say was a clear case of self-defense, she's now out of prison and her charges have been dropped. The case of Dandridge and her co-defendants, known as the Jersey Seven, have come to symbolize what many queer activists say is enduring homophobia and racist injustice within the criminal legal system and media. For more than a year, a group of Terrain supporters in the San Francisco Bay Area have been writing to the Jersey Seven. These unpaid activists talk regularly with family members of the remaining four women who are fighting their cases. They keep in touch with the lawyers and hold fundraiser parties to help cover legal costs. And they occasionally hold publicity-raising events, like this one at the Women's Building.
Fundraisers, so we have t-shirts over there, a bunch of nice t-shirts. Please get the t-shirts, and we have other memorabilia and things over here inside the bar.
This time, they even raised plane fare to bring out Terrain and her mother, Kima Walker, to celebrate Terrain's release.
It was great. It was very beautiful. Just all the support and just the love you can feel as soon as I walked in there. You know, and Angela Davis speaking, it was very emotional.
Terrain read aloud some of her writing from prison.
But let the justice system call it, I'm a big black dyke with no fears and not afraid to fight. I let them call the shots. Hell, do I have a choice? All I can do is sit in prison with my opinion and my choice of thoughts. Take me away from my family, the nerve of you. This man is still walking around harassing and assaulting, the nerve of you. But I got one better. I'ma still pray for you. Young, only 19 at the time, took me away from my world, still in my prime. 3.5 years to do. Yeah, they convicted me with time, but the moral of the story is, I never did the crime.
My name is Kima Walker. Terrain Dandridge is my daughter. I started organizing or trying to organize right after they were arraigned. And as of today, still stay in touch with the girls that remain in the facilities.
Speaking to an audience of hundreds, Kima recaps the night it all began, August 18th, 2006. She seems flustered as she reads from her papers.
I got a call at work from a friend of Terrain's who told me she had got arrested in New York City. After many calls, I located where she was and that she was to be arraigned at 100 Center Street at some time that night. I'm like, wow, arraigned. That didn't sound like a ticket. I collect myself and I get to the courthouse, only to be greeted by the paper and the TVs. As we sit and wait, a little before midnight, the girls were brought into the courtroom. They looked at, they didn't believe what was going on and couldn't wait for them to say, you can leave. Like myself, I'm sitting in the courtroom waiting for them to say something about a ticket or fine, and then we go. The ADA begins and says, they jumped and beat this man who was minding his business, blah, blah, blah. He simply said hi to one of the young ladies. She continues, Mr. Buckle, the alleged victim, has been taken to St. Vincent's and is in ICU. She said that they are charged with attempted murder, gang assault, and assault in the first and second degree. They were taken back inside. I sat there in my head. I'm like, what just happened?
Many people who organize around the Jersey 7 case say it was a classic trial by media situation. Attorney Andrea Ritchie is one of them. She lives in New York and works with Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, a national organization that has been following the case.
This is where the power of the police comes in, right? If they frame something as a gang, if they then, you know, any group of young people hanging out together, two or more, can get framed by the police as a gang. Once it's framed that way, then you turn on a narrative in people's heads that then is about this is a sociopathically violent group of people who are out to commit violence for the sake of violence, you know, and that these women were somehow out on the prowl that night looking for a heterosexual man to violate. And so, for instance, then after the incident, Fox News did this horrific, Bill O'Reilly did this horrific piece on lesbian gangs.
29-year-old Wayne Buckle was attacked by a lesbian gang here in New York City last August. Four of the women received prison sentences. In Tennessee, authorities say a lesbian gang called GTO, Gays Taking Over, are involved in raping young girls. And in Philadelphia, a lesbian gang called DTO, Dykes Taking Over, are allegedly terrorizing people as well. Joining us now from Washington, Fox News crime analyst Rod Wheeler. And
he actually got some expert who later, so-called criminal expert, who later, of course, recanted.
There's this national underground network, if you will, Bill, of women that's lesbians and also some men groups that's actually recruiting kids as young as 10 years old.
They just blew this into this threat to national security in a way that was also this very prurient thing about indoctrination into sexual acts.
Now, when they recruit the kids, are they indoctrinating them into homosexuality?
Yes. As a matter of fact, that some of the kids have actually reported that they were actually forced into, you know, performing sex acts and doing sex acts.
That just all came from the police sort of initially framing this as a gang issue. And, you know, of course, a group of young people of color and violence equals gang.
This is a lower socioeconomic crew, all right, who identify themselves as lesbian or gay. And they band together, just like some of the ethnic gangs do, to do harm. I mean, they just want to hurt people.
That's right. Well, the majority.
And there's no thought that someone else could have initiated the violence and that this could have been a response that involved self-defense. But not only did they get framed as a gang, but they got framed as a gang of killer lesbians, a seething sapphic septet. You know, there was all this notion in the media that one of the women growled as she was, you know, attacking this man, and there was a lesbian wolf pack. And granted, that was the sort of the Daily News or the Daily or the New York Post, which are known for their over-the-top and sort of Fox News-like coverage, if you want to call it that. But at the same time, they were getting fed those narratives and those ideas by the police who responded to the incident, who could have just as easily made this into a terrible hate crime or an attempted rape or an incident of street harassment or something else where the women would have been seen more favorably by the public, by the courts, and by the prosecution.
A group of girls, not a gang, going to McDonald's. They were all babies.
Kima Walker says it was obvious that her daughter, Terrain, and her friends weren't looking for trouble.
You know, and like Misha's the oldest, it was like they're all her little babies. They were just going to chill by the pier, and they were killers all of a sudden because they were accosted.
My family always told me, you know, once I was got old enough to hang out, you know, you go as a group and you guys stay together and this is, you know, and then we go do this because we were in a group trying to stay together. You know, you don't know which way to go.
There were seven friends out together who were subjected to a violent attack and responded in an effort to stay safe and get away, which is what we're told to do as women. But that's only what white women are supposed to do. And so black women are inherently threatening and therefore became framed as a gang.
One of the Jersey Seven convicted of felony assault charges is Linnea Daniels. A judge sentenced her to 5 years probation. She says that homophobia, plus society's fear of black people and lesbians, led to the media's distortion of this event.
What if we were straight? What it would have been the same thing? If it was seven straight women attacked at one man, and he started, would have been the same thing, would have got as much, what we be called killers or what we be called lesbians going wilding, that whole way how the media made it seem as though we were so much these crazy lesbians.
Kima says the courts were no better.
The ADA, she walked out wanting to give the girls these charges. She was, you know, excusing herself when she spoke in the manner of the girls being lesbians. You know, she felt as though she was, I guess, insulting the courtroom or something to that effect, because whenever she mentioned them, she would say, excuse me, Your Honor, you know, her girlfriend and things of that nature.
The court also plays a role in enforcing gender, racialized gender norms on people. This incident happened at 1 a.m. The court said, what were these girls doing out at 1 a.m. if they weren't looking for trouble? Again, as women, we're supposed to be home, and for good girls, we're home and safe and not on the streets at 1 a.m. There was also the issue of class that was enforced through the criminal justice system. The judge also said that we don't know how those girls were there because they couldn't afford to be there because now the West Village is so expensive. So that wasn't a place for them to be unless they were looking for trouble and looking to hurt somebody who legitimately belonged there, even though the guy who did this lived in Queens. He didn't come from that neighborhood either. So that's, I think, how those things sort of snowball and get played out at every stage of the criminal justice system, and how people can then be seen as deserving of enhanced punishment to really stamp out what we're most afraid of. And what are people more afraid of than black lesbians who are gender nonconforming? You know, I mean, that's a fearful image that gets created by the police and by mainstream media and by society and then fueled by this kind of incident.
And these are lesbians that actually carry pink pistols. That's 9mm Glocks. They use these, they commit crimes, and they cause a lot of hurt to a lot of people.
All right, Detective, thanks very much.
Attorney Andrea Ritchie says that in the rush to portray the young women as gang members, Buckle became cast by prosecutors and media pundits alike as an unlikely hero. Even the majority of activists who organize around issues of police violence did not take on the case of the New Jersey Seven, she says.
I think the story of resistance to police brutality and police misconduct and police framing and police overcharging and police lack of investigation and mass criminalization, mass incarceration is a story that has as its protagonist young men of color who are coded as heterosexual. And then there's a story of violence against women, which is one that features a non-threatening white woman who is considered innocent so long as she's racially non-threatening, she's behaviorally non-threatening, she doesn't engage in self-defense, she doesn't engage in self-medication, she doesn't engage in other criminalized activities like commercial sex or use of controlled substance. She's gender conforming, she's sexually conforming, she's not a lesbian, and doesn't engage in any deviation from gender norms. That's the story of violence against women. And then the story of homophobic violence, also known as hate crimes, is a story of white queers being subjected to homophobic violence and often actually by people of color in the story. So when you have those three narratives out there, then this story, which involved police profiling, police overcharging, police lack of response to violence, and police homophobia, didn't register as a story of policing, police brutality or police misconduct or police profiling. It didn't register as a story of violence against women, even though this man jumped on these women and ripped their hair out and physically assaulted them. And it didn't register as a story of a homophobic attack, even though the man who attacked them did so because they were lesbian and because they were queer.
Everyone that I knew who began organizing around this case identified heavily with what had happened and could see it happening to them.
You're listening to a special holiday documentary on Free Speech Radio News, The Story of the New Jersey Seven. You can check out our newscasts and documentaries online at www.fsrn.org.
The New Jersey Seven were assaulted and arrested in New York City's West Village, a historically queer neighborhood. Redevelopment plans threaten this relatively safe place for young queers who have few other places to seek and enjoy community. Supporters and queer activists familiar with this case say the attack on the Jersey Seven shows how the so-called revitalization of low-income areas displaces the most vulnerable people who have the least resources. Some groups are working to raise awareness about this issue. Fierce is a grassroots group that builds the leadership, political consciousness, and organizing skills of the LGBTQ youth of color in New York City. They host cultural events and work one-on-one with their youth members. Organizers there produced this video about what a hangout spot in the West Village means to homeless and queer youth of color.
Imagine that you have been persecuted your whole life. Imagine damn near everyone in your entire existence has turned their backs on you, just for being who you are. Imagine you finally find a place where you feel comfortable, a place where you're just another friend, not just another freak. Imagine there is nowhere else to feel normal. This place is real, right here in the heart of Greenwich Village. Within the past 2 years, I've been going to the pier off of Christopher Street. The pier is home to a large number of homeless gay youth, and it is the only place where young gay people can truly be themselves.
Basically, it's like a place where you could go and feel comfortable, because there's not that many places out here that's like that, you know. It's basically our place to go and associate with people who are in the life.
I think a lot of the young people go there for security. Because, I mean, I see a lot of them nowadays, and they go down there, right? And they go down there, and they can get in drags, they can fag out, they can do anything they want to do that they can't do at home. They can't do in their neighborhoods. Because, as a matter of fact, this morning I seen one that was at, he was at the pier, had on a wig and a dress and all this and all that, but when it came time to go home, all that came off and went into a backpack. It's haunting how I can't find myself again. My walls are closing in. Not a sense of confidence. I'm convinced that it's just too much pressure to take. I felt this way before. So insecure.
Under the leadership of Governor Pataki and Mayor Giuliani, 5 miles of the riverfront from Battery Park to 59th Street is under construction to become Hudson River Park. It's going to be transformed into a green and blue oasis for all of New York to enjoy. A new world, a
dazzling place I never knew. Now imagine that your place, the place where you feel is your second home, is now being bombarded by gay bashers who are harassing, beating, and murdering you and your friends. Imagine that the police who are supposed to protect you are no better than the criminals they have sworn to take off the streets.
You've just heard excerpts from Fenced Out, a youth-inspired, produced, and directed video created by Fierce, Paper Tiger Television, and The Neutral Zone. Fierce has screened the documentary widely in New York City, raising public awareness about the displacement, violence, and criminalization experienced by queer youth of color. Some activists working on these issues, including Andrea Ritchie from Insight, says that the increased police patrols are part of the city's plan to make New York's West Village into a playground for wealthy people.
It's been increasingly gentrified over the years to the point now where Sarah Jessica Parker lives there and Matthew Broderick. And, you know, it's a very upscale area of town now and predominantly white. So the police have increasingly been harassing and arresting queer youth of color for quality of life offenses, disorderly conduct, loitering. There's been incredible harassment and profiling and sweeps of transgender women of color for alleged sex work and loitering with intent to solicit and so on. So that's sort of the backdrop against which this incident happened.
Police harassment of gender nonconforming people, police sweeps targeting trans women of color, and laws that criminalize hanging out in public places are not exclusive to New York. The same thing is happening in the San Francisco Bay Area. Rallo T. Ampu is an activist who works against these repressive measures. He organizes with the Bay Area Solidarity Committee around the case of the Jersey Seven. He says he was inspired to take action after several murders of trans women in the San Francisco Bay Area shook the queer community.
As far as the conversations around self-defense were amongst the activists or queer community, it was always about these people that were dead. And it was always about vigils. It's always about this. And we were like, well, here are these people who are victims of violence or whatever, you know, who have experienced violence. And they're still alive, yet no one seems to be even remotely interested about it. And so we're like, well, wait, like, how did this happen? Like, how did this case get this far? It's obviously so completely ridiculous. It's an utter setup. Like, you know, it was really clear, like, you know, everyone that I knew who began organizing around this case identified heavily with what had happened and could see it happening to them. And so we were like, well, what can we do to prevent these things from happening again?
You hear about this case and you're outraged that it so much time has passed and no one did anything.
That's Bay Area organizer Inez Sunwu.
We decided to get together, and from that we decided to dedicate our organizing energy in freeing the NJ4.
She says the answer is to build a culture of self-defense in queer communities, as well as push activist groups to oppose homophobia. She says she was disheartened by the lack of response from radical movements to the New Jersey 7 case.
For me, I was trying to process through it, like, when are people going to see this as part of a broader issue? I was really, really upset about that, and just talking amongst my friends who were easily just as vulnerable based on their identities, and just together, like, we ended up deciding that what was also at stake was an ability to fight back, and that, you know, while we hope that all of these social movements are building themselves to be inclusive of queer struggles, we really didn't see that happening. And so it was a key element of our organizing is about just promoting that culture of self-defense as queers.
In June 2008, the Jersey 7 Solidarity Group organized a speak out at the San Francisco Dyke March. Inez made this announcement at the Women's Building.
One way where we're going to make sure that people know about the case is throughout the day we'll be around blasting our mixtapes, talking about the issues, doing a self-defense demo. We're going to have a punching bag. We're going to have people out teaching people. If you don't know how to throw a punch, that's okay. Come out and learn. Feel good about that because you might need to. You know, if you want, we're going to do demonstrations on how to practice self-defense. You know, just any chance we get to be in a supportive environment to reclaim that, then let's take it.
When you have so many identities wrapped up in one that are all vulnerable, then you have a very wide range of ways of being assaulted publicly.
And as attorney Andrea Ritchie says, it's these vulnerabilities that have kept this case from drawing support from the straight Black community. It's an oversight, she says, is tragic.
I think that it's really hard for people to understand and organize around the experiences of women to a certain extent, but queers to a much larger extent. I think that our experiences as women and as queers in the prison industrial complex are just not centered in the vision and the analysis and the organizing, so that those machineries of organizing and mobilization couldn't be put to serve to the call for justice for these women.
As of December 10th, 2008, all but one of the New Jersey Seven have been released. But much more work lies ahead. Patrice Johnson is still in prison and fighting her 8-year sentence. Renata Hill and Venice Brown are out on bail, but have retrials scheduled for 2009. Supporters are flooding the New York District Attorney's office with letters asking him to drop the remaining charges.
This whole situation is just like so cruel, and I just hope like everyone's listening and reading whatever you can do to help the girls and moving forward so that this situation never happens again.
That's Terrain's mother, Kima Walker, talking to NJ7 Linnea Daniels on the phone about some of the challenges they still face.
It really is beyond sad, you know, and we still have the girls that are in and the girls that are out. They have felony records.
Probation.
Well, yeah, but when you finish your probation, you still have a record. I'm talking about the end of the situation. You know, once you finish probation, okay, fine. But after 6 years, you have a felony record, and you're not deserving of that.
Right.
By no means.
Jobs that we have to get. I mean, with this record now, it's like, what type of good job can we actually get with felony on our chart, on our record? And ain't nobody going to be willing to hire us. All because of this.
No, that's what I'm saying. You know, probation, okay, yeah, you can go once a week, once a month, you know, whatever your time to go. So you do that for a couple of years. But even when that's done, it's not over.
Exactly.
That's what I was saying. It's just beyond not fair.
No, I just wanted to say one thing as far as, like, the media thing. Like, unfortunately, that's what the media did in this situation, was make every person angry towards lesbians in general. So that's why we all feel the way that we do feel as far as, now when we go out, people's going to more stereotype us than they did prior. It's just the whole, the media type thing looked at us as if we were just these horrible people. So that's why when we read the newspaper, it was like, where's my interview at? I didn't get to say what I needed to say.
The families of the New Jersey Seven and their supporters continue to move forward with their lives and try to overcome the injustices facing them. Meanwhile, in San Francisco, at the Women's Building, Angela Davis reminds an audience of hundreds that ultimately, it'll take more than legal victories to overturn what she says is an unjust system.
So, it's like we gotta get rid of all of this. And then we have. There's no way! There is no way! There is no way that we can expect, you know, to get rid of racism, no way we can expect to get rid of homophobia without an abolitionist posture. And so this is the message I want to bring to you today on behalf of, you know, all of my comrades and sisters and brothers who have been fighting for the abolition of the prison industrial complex for years and decades. We have to think of ourselves as 21st century abolitionists. How does that sound?
Yeah!
In San Francisco, California, this is Puck Low for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to a special holiday presentation from Free Speech Radio News. Catherine Comp edited today's documentary on the New Jersey Seven. The technical editors were Antonio Ortiz and Puck Low. You can check out our other documentaries online at www.fsrn.org. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Happy holiday.